When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Farmers Guardian is proud to work alongside the Rock and Roll Farming Podcast. For all the latest news and features from across the ag industry, head to fginsight.com. You'll also find a wide variety of advice pieces to help you and your farming business flourish.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Rock and Roll Farming is proud to be part of the Farm and Rural Ag Network. For more great agriculture-related podcasts and vlogs, please visit farmruralag.com. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 64. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I'm heading for the very first time to the Great White North, to Canada, to Endiang in southern Alberta to talk to Stuart Somerville. Stu, how are you?
I'm not so bad, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. It's so good to speak to you after following you on Twitter for so long. I really feel like I know you already.
Well, no, this is fun. I'm looking forward to it.
What does a typical mid-May Sunday afternoon entail at your place?
If we're lucky, we're seeding this time in May. Some years we're too dry and we're waiting for the rain, or we're too wet and we're waiting for it to dry up. Uh-huh. But this year we're in that sweet spot at the moment, so we're going hard.
Yeah, okay. And how much more have you got to do?
Oh, we've got, we don't put in a lot of crop ourselves, so we've got about 500 acres to cover.
Okay.
So a little work, but not too bad.
Yeah, okay. All right. And what about the area where you live then, Steve? How would you describe it?
Well, it's, I think a lot of people would think it's kind of bleak if they came here. We don't have much, we don't have much by way of trees. It's pretty dry for the most part.
Yeah.
Kind of a little bit hilly.
Yeah.
And it's always dusty.
Yeah, okay. So it's prairie country then?
Yeah, well, yeah, it is.
Yeah, right. Okay. And what would be the main crops grown in the area?
Well, it's starting to be canola within the past few years.
Okay.
I think canola has become the major crop. And from our point of view, it's a bit of a problem because it used to be barley.
Yeah.
And barley's disappearing more and more, and we depend on that for feed ourselves.
Okay, so why, canola, oilseed rape over here. Why are more people going down that route?
The price on barley hasn't been very good, and canola's been fairly strong for a few years, and people like having the Roundup Ready option on that crop. It's the main management solution everyone has out here, so there's a lot more canola acres every year.
Okay, and do you grow that yourself, or are you growing barley as well?
We grow a little canola, just as a cash crop and for a weed control option.
Yeah,
but the rest we'll put in for barley.
Okay, and you use most of that yourself?
Yes. Oh yeah, it disappears fast on my place.
Yeah. Okay. And what about livestock then in that area? Is it mostly cattle, I guess?
It's almost entirely cattle around here.
Yeah.
We do have a few neighbors who raise meat horses.
Okay.
That are shipped to Japan.
Wow, okay.
But we've never been associated with that ourselves. And then my wife and I, just to keep ourselves in trouble, we keep a few sheep on the side, but that's a little unusual around here.
Okay, is it? Yeah, right. Okay. Is that just, that's just a bit of a hobby, is it?
Yeah, it's hard to, because of the predators here, it's hard to have a good enough chunk of ground fenced off to a whole sheep in, so you're kind of stuck keeping them in small areas.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, well, I was going to ask you about that. What is that, when you say the predators, is that coyotes?
Yeah, the coyotes are the big one. Uh-huh. So I can go out most days and I'll see a dozen or more coyotes.
Wow, okay.
Around here. but we do have the odd wolf.
Okay.
I've never heard of anyone actually losing stock to them, but they do show up in the area.
Yeah.
And there's getting to be more and more cougars around here as well. A neighbor had a cougar in their yard just a few days ago.
Jeez.
And it had the community upset, because usually they don't come in too close to the buildings and such.
Yeah. So are they a problem with your cattle?
They're bad on horses. They generally cattle alone. Okay. I think they go for horses more because the horses are penned up, and so it's a bit easier to catch them.
Okay.
Cattle on range are usually safe from anything that we've got around here, though.
Right. Okay. And where would your nearest big city be? Would that be Calgary, I guess?
Yeah, I think for what most people would consider to be a city, Calgary would be the closest one we've got. our nearest center that we go to is about 45 miles away.
Okay.
But it's only it's about 4,000 people, 5,000 people there.
Okay. So how far away would your nearest neighbor be?
Well, my parents are our closest neighbor. They live a half mile away.
Okay. Yeah, okay. So, and would you go to Calgary much? I mean, I guess everyone will have heard of the Calgary Stampede. Do you go to that?
Well, my wife's family lives in Calgary right now, so we make it fairly often down there.
Yeah, okay.
But it's gotten to be, in the past few years, the roads have gotten a lot better,
mm-hmm.
and so it's not unusual for people to go to Calgary twice a month, three times a month, even.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay. The Calgary Stampede's kind of on our bucket list as a family. We'll get over there in a year or two when the kids are a bit bigger, I think.
Be cool. They'll have fun.
Yeah, okay. So you grew up on that farm. It's very much a family business, isn't it?
Oh, yes, yeah. We've been here for 100 years. More than 100 years, I suppose.
Well, okay. So would it have been your great-grandfather then came?
Yeah, it was my great-grandfather came. This wasn't his first farm.
Was that Virgin Territory then? Did he homestead it?
Yeah, it was homesteaded.
Wow.
When he came here, so it was there wasn't even our NDAing itself wasn't here yet.
Wow.
So he was here before that rush.
Yeah, okay. So do you know much about that? How did he come to settle there, do you know?
Well, I know he grew up in Ontario, okay. And there wasn't a lot of land available, and he had a large family.
Yeah.
So he and a couple of his brothers came west, and I'm not sure exactly how he ended up here. I know he started out closer to the mountains.
Yeah.
And I've heard that he didn't like the weather there very much. And so he came out here, which I think was probably a bad move on the whole, but...
Yeah, okay. That's really interesting. Okay, but so that was your father's side, your mother's side from a different country.
My mother's side mostly Americans, mm-hmm. down there. So my mom was born in California.
Okay.
And she grew up in Utah for the most part before she ended up here.
Yeah, okay. So have you got dual citizenship? You're half American.
I could have got it. I'd always meant to do the paperwork for it.
Yeah.
And then I went and got married, and apparently that made me ineligible to apply for dual citizenship.
Oh, did it?
Anymore.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. So when I finally got organized to look into it, I was about 6 months too late to apply for my citizenship.
Okay, all right. So where you are now, would you class yourself as a farmer or a rancher or both?
Well, I've always been a bit uncomfortable calling myself a rancher, although other people do call me one.
Okay.
The ranching thing is almost like a cultural marker little bit. I don't dress cowboy enough to get called a rancher most of the time.
Yeah, because it's a pretty big place you've got there, isn't it? 4,000 acres.
Yeah, it's around that. Yeah.
Yeah, and what is that? Is that a typical kind of size for the area? Is that sort of average? Or?
Well, that's sort of mid-sized now.
Okay.
It's certainly not big. There are quite a few farms still. People will have, or they'll have 300 or 400 acres on their place. You know, I don't know, maybe up to 600 acres on mm-hmm. the larger, small ones. But those people almost all have. They almost have income from off the farm.
Yeah,
okay. Who are doing that? So they'll work as they'll be tradesmen or things like that. But then there's the people on the other end. We have neighbors who will have 20,000 acres or more.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well. Yeah. I mean, 4,000 acres sounds big to me, but yeah, I guess it's relative, isn't it? So tell us a bit about your operation then. You mentioned you grow some crops. I know you've got a lot of cattle as well.
Yeah, we're mostly, we depend mostly on the cattle. Mm-hmm. So this year we calved out around 350 head.
Okay.
And we keep, most people out in this country, they wean and sell their calves right in the fall. They don't even background them.
Okay.
But we take them to finish, so long as we can make the cash work to get them to that point.
Yeah, okay.
So it means we do more feeding than most people do around here.
Okay, so what breed of cattle?
They're Maine and Jew cattle for the most part.
Okay.
We've at various times had some Limousine Cross and things like that, but it's still a Maine and Jew base on the whole herd.
Yeah, right. And where do you sell them?
Well, we have sold into, we've made the effort over the past few years to raise natural beef and to be certified to EU standards, which is a little unusual around here.
But okay.
We've been trying to sell into a special market.
Oh, well, okay.
So it's still sold, when we sell into that market, it mostly ends up here in Western Canada still.
Uh-huh.
But other times we are not able to, there's no openings in that market. So then we sell into the regular stream and ends up being to companies like Cargill that we sell to.
Yeah. Okay. And why did you choose to go down that route, for price reasons? Or?
A lot of it has to do with the premiums.
Uh-huh.
There are good premiums available if you're able to grab them fast enough.
Yeah.
And to survive now, you need to be doing something a little bit special if you want to make a go of it.
Yeah, okay. So what are some of the challenges you'd face farming in that part of the world? I guess, would the weather be quite extreme?
Oh, yeah, the weather is always a problem for
us
someday or another.
Yeah, okay.
We're fairly drought prone.
Oh, okay. Is that's the problem in summer?
Yeah, most years we end up with, well, we're worried about rain most years, but the past few years seem to have been especially ugly for it.
Okay. Is that, would you say that's getting worse, or is that just, it's just the way it is, the way it always has been?
It's, drought's always been a problem here.
Uh-huh.
They seem to be getting a little bit more severe.
Yeah.
So it'll be a longer period of time with absolutely no rain.
Yeah.
And when they end, they end a bit more spectacularly than they used to as well. We'll get, you know, we'll have 5 inches of rain fall on us in a couple of days, and we're just so swamped afterwards and don't know what to do with ourselves.
Yeah, okay. And what about in the winter? Would you get a lot of snow there?
You know, most years we don't get a whole lot of snow.
Okay.
We'll get enough to cover the ground, but you don't expect too much by way of drifts.
Wow, okay.
Out there, although this year, towards the end of the winter, we had a very snowy March, so we could hardly move anywhere without pushing our way through with a dozer blade.
Yeah, right. Okay. Because, I mean, I was expecting you to say that you're white over for sort of 4 months of the year, because obviously you speak to someone from Canada, you kind of expect that, but that's, obviously not with you.
Yeah, no, we have more brown winters than white ones.
Okay. Yeah, okay. And all your cattle, I mean, they're out all the time. They're out all winter, and you're feeding them outside.
Oh, yeah. When the weather gets bad, we try to take them to somewhere with thicker bush, and they can get down into the trees and hide a little bit. But we don't have buildings for them.
No,
we've no space for them at all. They're outside all the time.
So what? I was Googling you before this interview, and I found a news item a few years back where you had a plague of gophers. Was it a couple of years ago?
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
Is that? I guess that's a very unusual thing, is it?
The gopher, there's always lots of gophers around, but something about that year, it was a especially big number of them all at once.
Yeah.
And gophers love canola. They're murder on canola fields. So we were getting beat up by these little rodents everywhere.
Yeah. And they're like ground squirrels, are they? I've never.
Yeah. They're just squirrels.
Yeah.
But the same size and a little different color is all.
Uh-huh. And what could you do about it? Not much, I guess.
Well, you can try poisoning them.
Uh-huh.
That's probably the fastest way to deal with it. Mm-hmm. I always get a bit nervous about it because it's hard to control poison once it's out there.
Yeah.
But what we end up doing is we'll go and work on a field, and you pick everything up and burn it if you find any dead animals, and try to keep it from spreading beyond that point.
Yeah.
But with no, there's not really enough predators for them around here, so they're out of control awfully fast.
Yeah, okay. So that's, it's unusual to get a really big problem though, is it, when you were plagued with them, or is that, does that happen?
Yeah, for it to come to the point that it's a financial hit to have them around, that's a little odd.
Yeah, okay. All right. So people who follow you on Twitter might be surprised that you haven't always been a farmer.
No. No, that was I wasn't sure I was ever going to be at one time.
Yeah. I mean, when you were growing up, did you, I guess you would have had living there on the farm, typical farm childhood. Did you just weren't sure what you wanted to do, or was it?
When I finished high school, the weekend that I graduated high school was the weekend that they found the first BSE positive cow in Canada.
Ah, okay.
And I was sitting in the tractor when I heard that news. I was out, I can't even remember the field, I was out seeding in this big dry field that we have. It's kind of miserable. So you listen to the tractor, the radio to keep yourself from going crazy out there.
Yeah.
I heard this news report on, and I thought, well, I'm never going to be a farmer, because if I wasn't too interested in doing it if we couldn't keep cattle, and it didn't look like we were ever going to be able to have cattle after that. It, you know, no one knew just how bad it would get, but it looked pretty bad already at that time.
Mm-hmm. So what direction did you go instead?
Well, I decided I needed to do something. So the option that sounded easiest was I applied to applied for a bachelor's of education at the local college. I knew I could start the degree there and then see where it took me after that. Okay. And it seemed like a good backup plan. I knew I wasn't too interested in being in the big cities, but I knew there was lots of work for teachers in the other areas. So I thought I'd have a hope with that particular degree.
Yeah. Okay. What did you teach?
I taught mostly English and French.
Okay.
And then I taught, a few things on the side. I taught some history, and they did let me teach agriculture for a few weeks.
Did they?
Year.
Okay.
Yeah. But that was about it.
Yeah. Okay. So do you speak French? Or parlez-vous? Parlez-vous français, should I say?
I do. Yeah. Yeah, don't get much use out of it here, though.
Yeah, right. Okay. So did you, I guess you must have enjoyed teaching, though, because you did it for quite a while, didn't you?
I liked the teaching. I really enjoyed working with the kids.
Yeah.
And just being able to think through the problems and help them and stuff like that. But the problem with it is there's a huge amount of politics attached to it.
Yeah.
And you don't, when you're teaching, you don't just have one boss. I was okay with having one boss, but you had all the administration in your school who would come and tell you what you were doing wrong, and you'd have all the people from central office who'd come and tell you you need to be doing something else. And then the people from the government would come and tell you something on top of that. And you'd have town meetings giving you instructions about how you had to do stuff, and it just drove you crazy. It felt like you never got to do your job because you were dealing with all the stuff that was spinning around it.
Yeah, no, I would imagine quite a few people listening will have some sympathy with that. Yeah, okay. And then while you were studying to be a teacher, is that where you met your wife?
Yeah, we had class. The first class I had in college we had together.
Wow, okay.
But we didn't start dating until my third year of university. We ended up transferring up to Edmonton at the same time. We ran into each other in a hallway. One time there, we'd been friends with each other in college, but we never spent a lot of time with one another, and we ended up dating.
Did you
got to Edmonton?
Did you ask her out, or did she ask you out? How did that work?
I think it was sort of a mutual thing.
Oh, okay.
It was we ran into each other, and we had a bit of spare time and between classes, and we just decided we'd go grab a drink.
Yeah.
And then after that, because we had class at the same times in the same building, so we crossed paths, but the same time every day, so we just started to go get a coffee or a drink or something, and it turned into dating after a while.
Yeah, okay. And now you're married with how many kids?
Two kids, yeah.
Two boys, is that right?
Yeah, two boys tearing everything apart.
Yeah, okay. So when your wife isn't from a farming background, is she? She's a city girl, is that right?
Yeah, she's lived in the bigger towns or cities her whole life. She never had anything to do with farming. The first time she was on a farm was when I brought her home to meet my parents the first time.
Yeah, okay. So when you moved back to the farm, we'll talk a bit more about that. So how did she find that? I mean, it's a big thing moving out to, because it's not like you're just down the road from a town, is it? You're pretty isolated.
Yeah, there's not much by way of a town here. I think it was hard, actually.
Yeah.
I feel pretty guilty about that sometimes, that I drug her out here like that, because it's not an easy place to be.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's a great place to bring up a family, though.
Well, you can't. You really can't beat it. Mm. And like she says now, that she doesn't really think she could. There's stuff she misses about the city, but she doesn't think she would give up some of the stuff we've got here.
Yeah.
For that. Our kids run pretty wild outside most of the time.
Yeah.
Not a lot of restriction on what you can do and when you can do it and how. And it's quite nice.
Yeah, okay. So when did you decide to finish teaching and go back to the farm?
Well, I taught for 7 years, and there's a few things that kind of helped make this decision for me. One was, I think my dad was starting to get, I was always helping with farm stuff all along, but my dad was starting to get tired. It was getting hard for him to keep up with that much. And I just couldn't make up the difference in evenings and weekends and holidays and things like that. And the teaching was getting less enjoyable.
Yeah.
There was a lot of the schools get hurt the most with every political change, it seems. So everyone was playing at the schools, and I could see it just wasn't going to be a very nice place to be. And so I decided, well, if it was going to make the farm thing work, I needed to be here putting my work into that. And so we made it happen.
Yeah, okay. So how long have you been on the farm now?
This is, let me think. For 4 years, I've been just farming, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And you still happy with the decision?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, people ask me all the time, especially during calving, you know. And I don't sleep for a week. They ask me if I miss teaching. And I feel like I should say that I miss teaching, but no, I'm a lot happier here.
Good. Okay. So you, when I asked you what your future plans were, you said you wanted to keep learning how to be a proper cattleman. What do you mean by a proper cattleman? What do you mean by that?
Well, there's some people who, you see people who are just really good at the whole thing.
Yeah.
They're really good at knowing their livestock. They're really good at their grazing. They're really good at finishing animals. They're really good at, you know, they're stockmen.
Yeah.
I know how to get through with what I do with the cattle, but I really want to be, I want one day someone to say that I'm top notch at this.
You know? Yeah.
Even if they don't say it to me and I never hear about it, I just want someone somewhere to one day maybe think that, you know, to earn that reputation and to learn how to get there.
Yeah. So how are you going to do that?
I talk to lots of people.
Yeah.
You know, I try to talk to people who are doing really up to date things, and people who are doing things the older way. And I spend a lot of time in the evenings on the internet. Twitter's a great place for it, I guess. I end up looking and seeing just how people do things and the challenges they're up against and how they make their decisions. And you know, that's anytime I'm able to get out to a meeting where I can just sit and talk to people about the same sort of thing. It's the only way that I found right now that I can work towards that.
Yeah.
I wish there was a class I could just take somewhere for 6 months and say I've covered it, but I don't think it works that way.
Yeah, me too. Okay. So yeah, I guess part of that is, you're involved with a few organizations and programs in the industry. Is that something you enjoy doing? I guess you do you feel like you're putting something back without helping to contribute, or
I do, yeah. Because right now I'm a delegate with the Provincial Beef Producers Organization here. And so, I feel like I can bring the stuff, the policy things that I hear there, I can actually come back and talk to people about it. Because when you're just on the farm working, you really don't know what policy stuff is being talked about.
Yeah.
And you need to know that stuff so you can make your future decisions based off of that. And we're in sort of we're not in the most influential cattle area in the province.
Okay.
You get into southern Alberta around the feedlots down there, and they have a lot of influence over policy direction. And so I think it's important for people in my area, which is kind of, it's both marginal and has a small population. I think it's important for voices from there to get spoken at those meetings, because they need to know it. It needs to be said. And a lot of people aren't willing to go out there. I don't always know that I'm the best option to go and present these ideas and opinions and situations, but someone has to be doing it, and I don't mind it.
Yeah, well, that's I've started getting involved with a few things now as well, and for almost exactly the same reasons, actually. And I'm surprising myself how much I'm enjoying it. It's I never would have thought I would have been that kind of guy to get involved with these things, but I'm enjoying the interaction as much as anything. It's it's good.
It's nice.
Okay. So you also said to me one of your personal goals is to replace as much of the tractor work on the farm as possible with horses, partly for environmental reasons, and partly because it seems better for the cattle, and partly because it's fun. I thought that was really interesting. I think that's really cool.
Oh yeah. Well, I was just the other day talking with some neighbors who are a young couple, about the same age as my wife and I, maybe a year or two older, but they've already switched almost entirely to horses for what they can on their farm. And you see a lot of people around here doing it. It's just so much more satisfying to do it that way.
Yeah.
But it's, why not? If you can do it, why not do it? The people did it that way for a long time because there were some really good advantages to it. It wasn't just that was the only option available to them. They probably could have done it other ways. But summer work with horses, it was good work.
And
as much as I can, I'd like to fit that back.
Yeah. Have you always had horses? Did you grow up riding horses?
Not a lot. I had a little old sway-backed nag of a pony when I was a kid. She was a stubborn, nasty old thing. Knew every low-lying branch for miles around. She'd it would walk slow as molasses in January, getting out to some place, and she'd brush me off on a tree and come galloping back to the barn.
Yeah.
So that was how I learned to ride. Like when I grew up, it was quad bikes.
Yeah.
But for cattle work, all we used was quad bikes and pickup trucks. And actually, for a long time, I've had a saddle horse around the place for quite a while. Never used it much for the cattle work, though, just because I think my dad wasn't really comfortable with it. He grew up, when he was growing up, it was more horse work, and he kind of saw it as a progress to get rid of damn horses. And I don't think he necessarily enjoyed all of it. And because it'd be 40 below and you're feeding cattle out there, and I understand that. Of course, that's not the most fun thing in the world. Just not that long ago, I just decided one day I'm going to take the horse out and we're going to do the cattle work on the horse. It all went so nice. It was quiet and the cattle were happier and I was happier. It seemed worth it.
There's no heated handlebars on a horse, though.
Nah, you can wear mittens. That's all you need.
Is that something your boys and the family do together? Are you all doing a bit of that with the horses?
Well, my wife is a little scared of the horses still. Understandable, they're big animals that are up in their space. The boys, anytime I go out to horse work, as soon as I get back, they're both in the saddle and the guide, and I take them for rides around the place.
Yeah.
It's a big deal. They both come tearing out of the house in cowboy boots and hats, and they're ready to go.
That's awesome. Yeah, okay. All right. So in the notes you sent me, you casually put in that you ran for Parliament in 2008 and 2010. No more information, just that. But not everyone runs for Parliament, Stu. That's a pretty big deal.
I regret doing it.
Because you're pretty young then.
Yeah, I was, how old was I? I was like 21, 22 the first time I ran.
Yeah.
I just got a phone call one day from a friend who worked for that particular political party. And he said that they needed a candidate and asked me if I wanted to do it. And I couldn't think of a good reason not to do it. And so, yeah. So I did. I put my name in, and it was a good experience in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And it taught me how to do a lot of things. At the same time, just by having my name out there on some of that stuff, it burned some of my bridges, and not even intentionally, right? It was people just saw my name on that ballot associated with that party, and they decided they knew everything about me after that.
Yeah,
okay. And so I don't have a lot of love for the experience from that.
No, so you got no ambition to get back into politics, huh?
Yeah, it'll take a lot to change before I do that.
Yeah, okay. So you play the bagpipes. How does a kid growing up in the middle of Canadian prairies decide he's going to learn to play the bagpipes?
My mom was a bagpiper.
Okay.
And she actually, when she moved to Canada, she decided she was going to learn the bagpipes, and she found someone who did. And I ended up, I actually can't remember not knowing how to play them. I was pretty small when I started to learn. And I just stuck with it. I just loved it. It never did me much good, but I just loved doing it.
Yeah. How long did it take? How long? It takes a long time to learn, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Like, I was probably 6 or 7 when I started learning.
Yeah.
And I probably couldn't play them properly until I did something I called playing them, but I don't think it sounded much like music until I was 10 or so.
Yeah.
And then I probably still couldn't play them halfway decently until I was a teenager. So, it takes a while to get on top of that particular one.
Yeah. Okay. So how often do you pick them up now? Would you do that regularly now still? Or?
Not as often as I'd like. I wish I could do it every night.
Yeah.
I would do it every night and every morning if I could. And sometimes I manage that, but in the winter, everyone's cooped up in the house here together, and they don't necessarily want me playing the pipes all the time. And I get into the busy seasons, and my hands get all beat up doing some of the work. And the last thing they need to do is play any music right then. Uh-huh. So I go through some gaps now and then when I don't touch them too much.
Yeah, okay. And you actually competed in the World Pipe Band Championships back in 2004. That's a pretty big deal.
Yeah. Well, it was. I think we came dead last in the championship. So I don't know if that means you're the worst pipe band or not.
I guess it's still a very high standard, though. It must have been a hell of an experience.
Oh, it was so much fun. It was years and years of work to get there.
Yeah.
And then we spent, it was a full month that we were in Scotland for that.
Yeah.
And based in Glasgow, and the feature was the Worlds, but we did all sorts of other piping around the country while we were there.
Yeah, okay. So, you play a lot of musical instruments, don't you? Is the whole family musical? Do you sort of sit down together and play instruments? Or
we never play with each other, although we'll all sit down individually and just pick something up and play. So if I go down to my parents' house, my dad will just pick up the guitar and play around with it sometimes.
Yeah.
My mom's usually playing piano, and my wife sometimes plays piano, and sometimes she plays flute, and it depends on the mood she's in. And I have a sister who's actually a music therapist. That's her job. So she's always, playing with music, but we never play with each other. It's something we all do on our own.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's really cool. Okay. So I'm going to ask you about social media, because you seem to have quite an interesting point of view on a lot of issues. You're not afraid to voice those opinions on social media. Is it something you enjoy, the whole thing?
On social media?
Yeah.
Sometimes I really enjoy it.
Yeah.
Because I can feel awfully alone and isolated out here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think usually people can tell when I'm feeling a bit more depressed about being alone, I'm on social media a little bit more.
Yeah.
So it goes through waves like that. Uh-huh. Other times though, I just hate it.
Me too.
I just want to burn the whole thing down.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Would you consider yourself, correct me if I'm wrong here, but from someone who's followed you on Twitter for a long time, would you consider yourself to be quite liberal in what is generally a very conservative industry? Would you say that's a fair assessment?
Yeah, that's probably fair.
Yeah.
I'm usually a little nervous about getting called a liberal, because sometimes it's followed by a whole bunch of insults.
Yeah, well, there's a lot. Yeah, there's a lot of definitions of being a liberal, isn't there? I think you can look at it in a different. I mean, I would say I'm pretty liberally minded. I don't know if I'm a liberal, but I'm. I don't know. It depends what you define it as, doesn't it? But
I think I was really, my parents really encouraged us to be very accepting of mm-hmm. what we came up against.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just some of the experiences I had in high school and college and university might have made me lean a bit more towards some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the liberal side of things.
Yeah.
I try really hard to, I try to avoid getting stuck in with a particular set of ideas.
Yeah.
Because, I get really uncomfortable with anything that says, I guess in farming, we're pretty big on, well, this is the way it is because it's the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
Or we have, given truths.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that makes me really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It's kind of my nature to want to question that right away.
Yeah.
And I think that ends up slipping me into a bit more liberal mindset on some things.
Yeah, okay. And what's your opinion on social media and agriculture in general? Do you think, is it a force for good for the industry?
I think it's both for good and for bad.
Yeah.
And I think it's in pretty equal parts.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's done a really good job of helping us to connect with each other across mm-hmm. huge areas. So you have a better idea. It's not just what's happening in your three closest neighbors' yards that you kind of have an idea of their challenges and what they're going through. Or relatives who farm, you've got a much bigger sample of people to learn about and talk to from that.
Yeah.
And you've got a good chunk of people that you can turn to for advice sometimes. Mm-hmm. I've asked a few questions out there and I've gotten some interesting answers.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I think that social media, I think it's hit agriculture particularly hard for, making it seem that there's a right opinion and a wrong opinion
mm-hmm.
on a lot of things. And I don't know what it is about social media. People will blame the echo chamber.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think everyone's trying to not be in their echo chamber. these ideas gain currency and that this is the right way
mm-hmm.
and that that's the wrong way. And I guess my personal experience has been that there's such a thing as a wrong way. That's true.
Yeah.
But there's always dozens of right ways to mm-hmm. do stuff. And I think Twitter and Facebook to a lesser extent really gloss over that fact.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good way of putting it. So you mentioned, isolation, being on your own, and depression. Do you think it's definitely, I would say it's definitely helped a lot of people with that though. Just being able to pick up your phone and speak to people.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Just that, even if it's just 5 minutes of sending direct messages back and forth,
yeah.
with people. You can kind of vent your frustration a little bit safely and find out that you're not the only one feeling that way.
Yeah.
I think in extreme cases it's maybe saved a few people.
Yeah, I would say so too.
It's important. We needed that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd say, I think a lot of people listening would agree with that. It's, people have made a lot of good friends on there, haven't they? And I think, it's important. It's important. Yeah. Okay.
Well, you can end up in such a small world. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just through the airwaves, but it makes your world a little bit bigger and gives you a few more options and opportunities with that.
Yeah. Okay. So anyone who follows you on Twitter will know that you are, like me, a massive history nerd.
Yeah.
Have you always been the same since you were a kid?
Yeah, I've always loved stuff like that. I always just liked old things. I was a big reader when I was a kid, there was always lots of history books and historical fiction and stuff like that on the bookshelf. So I'd pull that off, and it's just been a big part of my life. So I've always been interested in it.
Yeah. We both discovered that we both grew up reading Rosemary Sutcliffe historical novels, didn't we?
That's right. I don't find many other people.
Honestly, I loved those books. What was your favorite?
I don't know if I could say how many times I've read The Eagle of the Ninth. That's probably the one I've read over and over and over again.
Yeah.
I'll still sit down and anytime I see one and read it cover to cover in an evening. I still love them all.
Yeah, I loved them. There was one called The Shining Company. I loved that one.
That's a good one.
I was so disappointed with The Eagle of the Ninth, the movie, though. It was dreadful, wasn't it?
Oh, I wanted to throw it across the room.
Oh, man, I picked it up. But so disappointing.
I was excited when I heard they'd made the movie, and then I watched, I don't know, 20 minutes of it, and I thought, oh, geez, this is...
Me too.
That was too much of a letdown.
Yeah. So you're also, I know you're very interested in the people like your great-grandfather, the early pioneers over there, and also the native people of Canada, obviously.
Well, I guess... people sort of have this habit of thinking that the history started here with the settlers who came in late 1800s, early 1900s. But, you know, there's 20,000 years of history.
Yeah.
History and stories and culture and traditions and it's all right there, and we don't talk about it. And so I really like getting to learn about that and read about that. And it's also a sort of current events thing too, because there's still so much tension.
Mm-hmm.
There's tension and real damage that's been done in recent times here in Canada, and it's a important issue to be addressed. And so, when you look at the whole thing together, I can get sucked quite deep into that.
Yeah, because I know you've posted on Twitter quite a lot about this sort of the native place names and things like that. It's super interesting.
Well, yeah, it always seems strange to me that our lakes around here almost all got named in the 1910s. At the latest, some of the earlier ones maybe got named in the 1880s or so.
Mm-hmm.
But it always seems strange to me. I'm pretty sure that the Cree people and the Blackfoot people who live here, you know, they didn't call that Sullivan Lake over there. That probably wasn't what they called it. It probably had a name for a lot longer before that, and it seemed a shame that we just don't talk about that. And I'm sure someone somewhere knows all of these things, but it's not in the books or the maps that we find normally.
So
I find it really interesting to go hunting after that stuff.
Is there growing interest in that in Canada? I mean, would there be talk of maybe those place names sort of replacing the more modern names or anything like that or not?
You do see it in some places. It gets brought up. I think that a lot of people would like to see those changes made.
Yeah.
I think that it's unlikely that many of them will get made.
Mm-hmm.
People, People in power don't like change very much. Yeah. And even if it's things like that, that might not seem quite as important.
Yeah.
But there was there's been efforts, some people trying to get all the creening for Edmonton and city signs and things like mm-hmm. that. So there is interest in that sort of thing.
Yeah.
In the area. I think it's good, but I don't think it's going to massively change in the near future.
Yeah, okay. And I know you're also very interested in your family history, because you post a lot of old pictures, these amazing portrait pictures of your ancestors. I love following you on Twitter, Father. Brilliant.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's I guess I like telling stories in mm-hmm. general.
Yeah.
And I feel like those are stories that I can tell. I'm not stepping on anyone else's toes to go out and tell those stories and share those pictures. It seems like well, I'm interested in it, but it also seems like it's something I can safely talk about.
Yeah.
I guess I talk about it because I hope other people will talk about theirs too.
Yeah.
And look around and find out, because I don't think I've got any better. I've maybe found some good pictures, but I don't think there are better ones that exist in my family than anyone else's, or that the stories are any better.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why everyone's not interested in going
to that. Me too. So, I mean, why do you think that link to the past is so important to you? Has it just always been there?
Yeah, well, I think you kind of have to understand the past to make any kind of intelligent decision about the mm-hmm. future.
Yeah.
And you need to understand the past to understand why the present is the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're gonna move forward, if you're going to improve things, sometimes you need to look at the past and see that, well, for example, that people did do something better in the past than we do now. And so maybe that's a direction to head, or that we do something better now than they did in the past. So, well, we're on the right track. We can keep going that way. I think it's, some people kind of look down on spending too much time looking at the past, but mm-hmm. I don't know. I think that's a mistake. I think it's an awfully important place to pay attention to.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And Somerville is a Scottish name, isn't it? Your family came from Scotland, from the Highlands.
Yeah, yeah. well, from all over Scotland, really. Of my four grandparents, three were from good Scottish families.
Yeah.
We grew up with Scottish everything around us. It's probably more Scottish in our house than it is in some houses in Scotland sometimes. I had a professor in university who always talked about how there's none so Scots as the Scots abroad, and it's pretty true. It's like Scotland throws us up in the house.
Yeah, okay. So have you got family tartan and all the kit?
It's hard to get Somerville tartan. I have a tie in Somerville tartan. My own kilt that I've got is it's in Blackwatch tartan.
Okay.
Just because I'm
that's one of the cool ones.
Easy to find, that helps too.
But
a lot of my family was in the Blackwatch at various times, so
okay.
There was kind of a connection there to that, and that was attractive.
Yeah, okay. So Somerville's quite an unusual name, isn't it? Really, it's quite.
Well, it was French at one time.
Yeah.
And then it come over and into Scotland, and they changed the spelling 20 or so times, and and everyone still fights about how to properly spell it. But here we are.
Yeah, yeah. Any relation to Jimmy Somerville of 80s pop group The Communards? Don't suppose so.
No, I've been asked that before, but have no, you? None at all.
I didn't know whether you'd have heard of the Communards, but I'm a big fan of Don't Leave Me This Way. It's one of my favourite songs.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, that's really interesting. So, I guess that's part of playing the bagpipes. It must really sort of stir the soul for you.
I suppose so. I don't know that it's necessarily Scottishness that makes you like it.
Yeah.
There was a fella I used to play with who was Slovakian. He actually liked it because his family played a kind of bagpipes back in Slovakia.
And
he thought it was kind of neat to be doing it here too. but like, I don't know, I feel I'm at my most comfortable when I'm playing the bagpipes.
Yeah.
And so that's when I kind of relax and my stress goes away. So I don't know, maybe there's something in the nerves that like that sort of thing.
Yeah. Okay. And have you got any plans to get over to Scotland again? I guess it's hard to get away now with the farm and the kids and everything.
If I can ever get this place ticking along the way mm-hmm. I think it should, then we're going to take a little bit of time and go over there. But it always seems like for every step forward we make, there's four or five steps backwards, and so the trip gets postponed a little bit longer.
Yeah, no, I know the feeling. Okay. All right, let's see. Well, I always wrap this up with a little traditional five-question quiz. So if you're ready, I will kick in with those.
All right, then.
Okay, what's your all-time favorite song?
My all-time favorite song?
Mm-hmm. If you had to pick one.
All time. Oh, the answer could change from week to week. But
yeah.
I think right now, I'd say my all-time favorite song is Preaching the Blues by Sunhouse.
Oh, that's a good choice. I like that. Okay. If you were banished from Canada, you couldn't live there anymore, where would you choose to live instead?
Iceland.
Definitely
okay. Iceland.
You've been there, haven't you?
I have. There's no mosquitoes in Iceland.
Yeah, okay. I bet it is a cool place. I know people who've been, and they all say it's ice.
Yeah, it's beautiful there, yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right, what's your favourite traditional bagpipes tune?
My favourite tune? My very favourite to play is Caberfae.
Okay.
Which is the horns of the stag.
Yeah.
And there's different versions of it set as different arrangements, but it's still the same tune. And I love playing that one. Something about it, just you cover the whole chanter and the whole scale, and it's fun to play. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I like Blue Bonnets Over the Border. I think that's one of my favourites.
Yeah, it's a good one too.
Yeah. Okay. So you are hosting a dinner party. You can have any three people from history there. Who are you having?
Any three people
from history.
From all of history.
All of history.
I think I'd want Genghis Khan.
that'd be fun.
And I'd want... I need two more. I think Martin Luther would be interesting.
Uh-huh.
And...
Yeah.
I need one more good one. Oh, I'm going to go with, let's see. I always thought, I think Thomas Jefferson would have been quite the guy. You could have had a heady conversation with him. That would be my three.
I approve. Welsh American Thomas Jefferson from ancestors, ancestors from Snowdonia. So yeah, I approve of that one. Yeah, okay. And lastly then, if you had to recommend a farmer or someone involved in agriculture to follow on social media to a non-farmer, who would it be and why?
My lazy man's answer would be to follow James Rebanks, Herdy Shepherd.
Yeah.
There. I think he does an excellent job.
Yeah.
But if I were to think a bit harder and say for my more local part of the world, at least mm-hmm. for North America, I would suggest Jay Lazy S. Cheyenne. He does a good job showing Western North American ranching, at least.
Yeah, Cheyenne's she's a rock star, isn't she?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Stu, thanks so much for speaking to us today. I've loved it.
Oh, no worries. It was fun.
Yeah, no, it's like I said at the start, I feel like we've talked so much on there and I've followed you for so long. I feel like I know you already, but when you actually speak to someone, it's so much better.
It's always different, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, okay. All right, then, take care, sir. And if you do ever get to that trip over to Scotland, you know where we are.
That sounds good. I'll keep it in mind.
Okay. All right then, Sue. And yeah, take care. And to everyone at home, thanks for listening and see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.